Afternoon. I'm going to call the meeting to order. This meeting is going to be held in accordance with House Rule 10.01, which is posted online. Mr. Smith, would you conduct the roll call, please?
Yes. Chair Sundin is present. Vice Chair Bang. Bang. Anderson.
Anderson present.
Anderson present. Burkle. Burkle? Eklund.
I'm present.
Burkle present. Eklund?
Present.
Eklund present. Hansen R.
Hansen R. present.
Hansen R. present. Hansen J.
Jay present.
Hansen J. present. Cleavorn.
Cleavorn present.
Cleavorn present. Lippert.
Lippert present.
Lippert present. Lewick.
Lewick present.
Lewick present. Miller.
Present.
Miller present. Nelson.
Present.
Nelson present. Thompson. We do have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Minutes of the last meeting are posted. I'm assuming that Vice Chair Vang has read them. Is she present yet? Okay, I don't see her. Representative Anderson, do you please move the minutes? Would anyone like to move the minutes?
I'll move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Eklund's moved the minutes of the previous meeting. I'm sure everyone's read them thoroughly. Any corrections or additions? Hearing none, all of those in favor of approving of those minutes, say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay. Okay, those minutes are adopted. Today, we're going to have a budget review from the Board of Animal Health and then two bills. We blocked about 50 minutes for the Board of Animal Health and then the remainder for the bills. All the meeting material is provided ahead of the meeting and are posted on the committee website. Dr. Thompson, you are up first. Please introduce yourself and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Sundin, and give me a moment here. If you all can let me know if you can see my screen.
Yes. Thank you.
Excellent. Chair Sundin, members of the committee, my name is Beth Thompson for the record, and I am the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Animal Health and also the state veterinarian. I will try to keep within my 15 minutes for all of you, and I appreciate the time that you guys have allotted for me for this presentation. First of all, you know, we always like to start off with a little bit of a historical context, and the Board of Animal Health traces its origins back to the days of tuberculosis and glanders. And I'll call your attention to the upper left side of the screen. Dr. Bacon called out for assistance for cases of glanders in horses. Now, glanders is a zoonotic disease. That means that it can be shared between people and, in this case, horses. And the Department of Health back in those days learned that having a veterinarian's perspective and assistance was helpful. It was the work that was done, you know, very early in the state by our veterinarians with the Department of Health that led to the establishment of the board. And I also want to point out for you history buffs, the Board of Animal Health has been in place since the early 1900s. Our focus is animal health. And another historical fact, Dr. Ward, who is pictured in the bottom left-hand corner, served as state vet. Then he left and he went to Canada, of all places, to work on food and meat safety issues, and then returned to the state veterinarian position here in Minnesota. But if you notice, if you can see, unfortunately, he did die of influenza in 2018, and a new veterinarian, state veterinarian, needed to be hired. So by statute, our chapter is chapter 35. By statute, the board is made up of five members, three of which are livestock producers, two are veterinarians. Our current board members, I've got listed on the screen, And in addition to the citizen board members, the board also has the Commissioner of Ag, the Commissioner of Natural Resources, and the Commissioner of Health, in addition to the Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine and the Director of the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, who all serve as consultants to the board without vote. By statute, we also have quarterly board meetings, and our next board meeting is scheduled for next Wednesday, a week from today, and that information is on our website. So we've gone to a virtual format, and I'd invite all of you to join us if you have the time. Board staff, moving into our organizational chart. Our board staff are located in the St. Paul office, and that's a building we share with the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health. We also co-locate some of our staff with the Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab at the Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab in Willmar. And then we have field staff that are located throughout the state. So the blocks on the schematic that I've got up on the screen right now, the green, those are our field staff. So you can see kind of where they're located within our org chart. Throughout the years, we've maintained a staff of approximately 40 employees. Sometimes there's more, sometimes there's less, depending on the diseases that we're facing. You can see from the screen, we have a couple of vacant positions right now, one in the field, a couple in the St. Paul office. And then lastly, before I move on from this slide, so we generally divide our program work by species or disease or a general area of concern. So if you look, for example, over on that right, towards the middle, towards the right, Dr. Hafes, that's Brian Hafes. So he oversees the swine programs and the horse programs, but he's also got livestock concentration points. So that would include things like fairs and exhibitions and livestock markets. I always include a picture of the Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab every year. That ongoing relationship between the Board of Animal Health and the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab is crucial. Minnesota is the nation's leader in turkey production. We also have very strong chicken, broiler, egg production in Minnesota. And we also sit in an area up here in Minnesota that's very strong in agriculture. And thank you to the legislators currently on this committee and those that were integral in funding the updates to the Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab after our 2015 highly pathogenic avian influenza event. This lab is located in the heart of poultry production in the state and is really a hugely important resource, not only for the farmers around that Willmar area, but really across the state. And as I mentioned in a previous slide, the Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab director is a consultant to the board and presents updates during our quarterly board meeting. That ability to plan and respond for high level and important animal diseases is a priority of our agency, and we cannot do that without a strong veterinary diagnostic lab. So a shout out to the Minnesota VDL. One of my predecessors is famous for the quote about what the board does. We're like a volunteer fire department, according to Dr. Haggerty. Everything that we do day to day is in preparation for a foreign animal disease or a disease of human health concern or economic concern. Our field staff, along with the United States Department of Agriculture, or USDA Minnesota field staff, are trained to respond to animals with clinical signs consistent with foreign animal diseases. In addition to that, our field staff are trained to respond to possible rabies, other zoonotic concerns, and we have responded when asked to what are known as transboundary diseases. An example of that is porcine epidemic diarrhea virus. So this slide up at the top, I've got listed detect, control, and eradicate. So detect means that we train and work with veterinarians in the field and farmers to spot and report disease. Control means that we are tracking and tracing, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few slides. And then when necessary, we eradicate disease like we did with bovine tuberculosis in northwestern Minnesota. And we can't do all of this without established relationships. So we look to USDA, Department of Agriculture, other state agencies. And again, going back to our relationship with the Department of Health here in Minnesota, an example, a few years ago in Minnesota and some other states were seeing zoonotic outbreaks of sole virus, which is a rare rat disease. It's a virus, and rat with an R. We stepped in at the request of the Department of Health to assist. We continue to monitor for diseases such as avian influenza, other foreign animal diseases, and our veterinarians all work on establishing roles and relationships with commodity groups, concentration points, again, those fairs and exhibitions and sales, local authorities and groups and individual farmers, and across state lines. We also work on these same areas within companion animals. Canine brucellosis is a good example of a very concerning disease that's zoonotic. When we get a positive or suspect test, we immediately alert the Department of Health. And again, I probably should also mention again, rabies is another one of those diseases that is a zoonotic disease, is shared between animals and humans. So an important aspect of disease control is applied with emergency planning and preparedness. My thanks to the Department of Ag and all other state agencies that assist the board in responding to foreign animal diseases. If and when we see a foreign animal disease, and highly pathogenic avian influenza was an example, our agency of 40 people can't handle it alone. So on the left side of your screen, you see a photo of an exercise activity that was held fairly recently. The board's communication director and our emergency planning director are standing on the outside of that group. And then we have a IT person, a mapper, and the Department of Ag interim emergency director all pictured. So when a foreign animal disease strikes, all of agriculture comes together. In a few slides, I'll discuss some of the other diseases, but overall, the importance of working together in a Minnesota response is imperative. We have emergency disease management committees stood up for both poultry and swine. These committees serve and meet on a regular basis, and the members of these committees include the University of Minnesota, other regulatory agencies, farmers, vets, slaughter plants, researchers, and others. Emergency response also includes state-to-state work and communication. I'm in regular contact with North Central states, the states up here in the Midwest. We share ideas and we work through planning all together. And so speaking of other states, I have to pull out one program. Minnesota enjoys a very modern system for tracking and tracing animals. We all know that animals move across our state lines from farm to farm, also moving within our state. But animal disease traceability is defined as the ability to efficiently and effectively track livestock for disease purposes. This includes not only record keeping, but those official ear tags that are placed in animals. Animal disease traceability is a component to animal health. It's part of our system of what we do across state lines, and it's not meant to be a state standalone initiative. Whether we're talking about cattle or hogs or sheep or deer and elk or other species, Minnesota truly is a leader in traceability in the United States. So very quickly, moving on to some current events, we currently have a H6 virus, a low-path avian influenza virus that is found out in western Minnesota. There have been a couple of farms with clinical signs and mortality, but the vast majority of cases over the past few months have not had many signs. Since this is low pathogenic, there is an industry response, and the board is in a supportive role. And I can answer more questions about this if needed and get into some more detail. Second bullet point up there, of course, COVID, SARS-CoV-2, the infection in domestic animals, and livestock populations. We did diagnose, Minnesota did have SARS-CoV-2 diagnosed in a domestic cat fairly early on, back in the spring. And then there was also a large cat diagnosed in a facility located in Pine County more recently. So another example of working hand in hand with the Department of Health. And if you're interested, any of the members are interested, I'd really recommend viewing the CDC website. They have a couple of pages dedicated to SARS-CoV-2 in domestic animals. The third bullet point there, I've got another slide coming up on African swine fever, so I'll save my comments on that one. And then lastly, CWD, chronic wasting disease. In October of 2020, an animal located in a herd in Houston County down in southeastern Minnesota was diagnosed with chronic wasting disease. Houston County is part of the wild endemic area, wild deer endemic area. That herd was depopulated in January. What's interesting about this case is that the farm had been double fenced since before CWD was found in the wild in that area. So to be clear at this point in time, the herd has been depopulated and we're still awaiting results from the National Veterinary Services Lab. So we will wait to see if there are any other positive animals on that site, and the board will be issuing a press release when that information comes out. Circling back, African swine fever, there has been a lot of work that has been done, but we still need to do more. With African swine, oh, you know what? I'm on the wrong slide here. Let me back up in my notes. Here we go. Okay, so back to the COVID-19 response. It seems like May was years ago because of all the work that was done across the state and state agencies on COVID-19. Our area for doing work, of course, is animal disease. We also work with animal owners and veterinarians. As you can see in the list, we assisted in the formulation of how vet clinics and individual veterinarians could continue their work. That was very important work. We put guidelines in place for exhibitions, shows, sales of animals. And we continue to work with the Department of Health on cases of possible COVID-19 in animals, especially companion animals. And I need to make a call out to our Minnesota veterinarians. They did just an amazing job of working out plans on how they could continue to care for animals. And again, I'm talking both livestock and pets. And they continue to do that in very important work within the Minnesota guidelines. So a big thank you to veterinarians. So now, African swine fever. I've got a map up of the World Organization for Animal Health from December of 20, so about 6 weeks old. For those of you who aren't aware, African swine fever, you can see that we have no red on the North American continent, which means we have not had it here in North America, Canada, the United States, Mexico. African swine fever is considered then a foreign animal disease. It can be transmitted through pork and pork products, so raw, frozen, dried, undercooked pork products. And the virus can survive for a long time. On a federal level, there's been work done on border customs and controls, warning signs for those of you who may have seen those in airports, not allowing the pork and the pork products into our country. And state animal health officials here in the U.S. continue to request more oversight on what is coming into the U.S. because that could be a route of delivery of this virus into the U.S. And if you look over into Europe and especially Germany, they're really struggling. They found the disease in wild boar, those wild feral swine that they have across Europe. And fortunately, in Minnesota, we do not have an established population of wild boar, but we do know that populations of wild pigs sit just north of us in Canada, and then certainly in the southern United States. So on a state level, I and Dr. Hayes and Dr. Suskovic are all involved in a number of national, regional, and swine-producing state efforts on enhancing our ASF, our African swine fever response. Like the response to avian influenza, if and when we do see African swine fever in the U.S. or even on the continent, we will need a swift response. The clinical signs can be muted. They don't show up immediately, and there is a good chance that the disease could spread unknowingly. So we need not only our staff and other staff from other agencies to be ready to respond. We also need our lab to be able to respond. And we really need to focus in on both this disease and on avian influenza. quickly shifting to the farm servant rule changes, a few, and I'll let you guys read through this slide as I'm talking, but I did want to make a couple of comments just generally about the farm servant program here in the United States. You know, as I've mentioned, we look to other states and how they run their programs, sharing ideas and comments and what works and what doesn't work. And just very generally, in seven states, the State Department of Agriculture or the Board of Animal Health has jurisdiction over farm servants. So that's seven states. And Minnesota, of course, is one of those. In eight states, it's the Department of Fish and Game or Natural Resources, that equivalent. They have jurisdiction over farm servants. And then in the vast number of states, it's 35 states, servant farms are jointly managed between the two agencies. Additionally, just so you all are aware, and you can look at our 2020 annual report, the amount of time and dollars spent on specific programs for the board is listed on page 18 of that report. And so farm servant, we spent a goodly amount of our time on this program during fiscal year 20. Approximately 20% of the board's funds were used for the farm servant program, which is level with the amount of time that the board has spent on the poultry programs. And those two programs come out on top. Other programs and other species are used at lesser amounts. Moving on then, I think I'm going to move quickly into the funding sources for the board. Generally, the board's funding remains stable as to the sources. So up on the screen, I'm showing that we've got 78% of our funds come from the general fund, 12% come from federal cooperative agreements, and then the remaining 10% I've got listed there. We've got some specific servant funding, emergency preparedness funding, and then some miscellaneous revenue. And this generally holds true year to year, that split, the 75 to 80%, and then additional amounts coming in from specific funding lines and the federal government. So as to the governor's recommendations, we are an employee-driven agency, and so usually I say 65%. It looks like it came out at 66%, and it looks like it came out at 65% of our agency budget. Coming up for this fiscal year 22 is salaries and fringe. Our next big budget item is the contracted vendors. So those would include interagency agreements. We have some with the Department of Agriculture for human resources, safety advisor, and other agreements. We also have a contract for our database supplier. We also have contracts in place with the veterinary diagnostic lab for avian influenza testing and chronic wasting disease testing, and then a few smaller contracts. And then you can read from that slide the additional budget lines that we have: information technology, travel, rental space, and then some miscellaneous other expenses. And then in this next slide, basically it's the same for fiscal year 23. There's a slight change because of a reduction in salary in fiscal year 23. That's actually due to a reduction in part-time forecasted labor. It's not a reduction in full-time salary and benefits. Salary and benefits, you know, this is working within the governor's budget. And some of this was done to absorb the rising costs of business, such as the rent and the IT costs. And that's something that the governor's budget recommendation actually accommodates. So a slight change from fiscal 22 to 23, but again, generally, you know, salaries and fringe take up the vast majority of the funding that comes to the Board of Animal Health. And hopefully, Chair Sundin, I've kept it within the allotted time, and I would stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. As a good educational presentation here, are there any questions for Dr. Thompson? I see, in order of appearance, Rob Eklund, please. Representative Eklund, Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Thompson, long time no see, I guess, but thank you for your presentation. How many Cervidae farms have been depopulated in the last 3 years, Dr. Thompson?
Oh, goodness. Last 3 years, we've got the Houston County herd, and then we had herds associated with the Pine County herd. Don't hold me to it, but I want to say 5 to 6.
Okay.
But I can get you that exact information. I have to look back on the exact years, Representative.
Mr. Chair.
And follow up, Representative Beckman.
Thank you, Dr. Thompson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment, if 20% of your staff time and finances are going to a agriculture operation that is this small, if I'm not mistaken, there's about 100 whitetail farms in the state and about 300 total cervid farms in the state. Compared to our pork producers, poultry producers, and cattle, it seems like a significant amount of your budget is going to such a small part of our agriculture industry in the states. I'll be interested in looking forward to working with you and others on seeing how we can remedy that. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Thompson.
Chair Hansen, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Thompson. Good presentation. I guess I would note, you know, after listening to these presentations for a few years, the energy and the adjectives used in the response to African swine fever or avian influenza are contrasted with the adjectives responding to CWD. So like quick response, working internationally, making sure things aren't moving across the border, rapid response, trying to protect, trying to prevent. It seems that, you know, the legislative audit report on cervid farms, I think now is 3, maybe 4 years old. The rulemaking has taken a while. And I still have some concerns about the rulemaking. But clearly that this industry does not pay for its regulation, that the taxpayers in Minnesota have to step in and pay significant amounts of money for the maintenance of the regulatory system for the farmed whitetail deer industry. So I guess I'm concerned. It's clear in listening and watching the presentations. I understand the threat of African swine fever and avian influenza. We've been through that before, but we have not a foreign disease, but an actual disease that could be extremely insidious. The funds that we've provided to the University of Minnesota for research are doing groundbreaking work that could show that this is very threatening and maybe more extensively threatening than we have even can even comprehend. And I see more of a passive approach compared to the others. And so just my observations relating to the farmed whitetail deer industry, and I don't know how we do that. I think you're going to see a variety of bills trying to address these problems.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. Dr. Peterson, you'd like to respond to those comments?
Chair Sundin, Chair Hansen, thank you for the comments. And I guess I would have to go back and take a look at the presentation itself. I can tell you that when I talk about at least 20% of the board's staff and time being spent on farm cervids and chronic wasting disease, we're not taking it lightly. Not to disagree too strongly with you, Chair Hansen, but respectfully, we do spend, I had the numbers pulled this morning for the last 6 months, and the amount of time that's been spent just from the last half of fiscal year 2020 was pretty astounding. It has to do with the rules process that we're going through. And in response to that comment about the rules process, honestly, we want to do it right. We want to take our time. We want to make sure that we are getting input from as many different interested parties, interested groups, interested individuals, researchers. You know, I know Dr. Glazer just this morning was corresponding with Dr. Larson over at the University of Minnesota. And then to that point, also being involved on a federal level and state-to-state communication. I appreciate that government doesn't move as quickly as some of us want it to, But again, I go back to the board does want to do this right because it is an important disease. So thank you for the comments, Chair Hansen.
Okay, Representative Miller, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my comments can be very brief. And actually, before the other member spoke, it was just going to be a thank you to Dr. Thompson and the Board of Animal Health. Anyone that knows me knows that I get a little chippy on how government agencies work. And I just want to compliment Dr. Thompson and the Board of Animal Health that they've been one of the agencies that really do things right. You look at their budget, it's very tight to what they do. They get their work done, they do it well. I'm frankly a little surprised that I'm feeling like this presentation now was a setup for an indictment on cervid farmers and their deer. And we certainly need to have that conversation, but it tied directly in with the Board of Animal Health presentation was a bit disappointing. So that's the only comment that I have on that. But thank you, Dr. Thompson, and thank you for Board of Animal Health for the outstanding work that you've done. I was here during the avian influenza outbreak, and a lot of people did a lot of good work, but you really shined above and beyond. And I know that nationwide, they took note of the way the Board of Animal Health dealt with that and has dealt with diseases in the state of Minnesota, and people think that it's an outstanding work. So thank you for that.
Dr. Thompson, do you care to respond?
Thank you, Chair Sundin. No respond. Thank you.
Thank you. I think Representative Lewick was up next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A little bit of an echo of Representative Miller's comments. My detailed involvement with the Board of Animal Health goes back to when we had a tuberculosis outbreak in our livestock herd in northwest Minnesota. All the markets were slammed shut. You couldn't move cattle, all kinds of stuff. And this is one of the things that may surprise you, or some, particularly those that are not familiar with the background of what happened up there in that area. We knew, when I'm talking cattlemen, we knew from firsthand experience that the deer, the white-tailed deer, were commingling on the same food source as the cattle. And I'm going to tell you, we literally had to kick the shins or kick them in the face. And I'm talking about our brothers in the DNR to force them to even accept that we needed to test the white-tailed deer for tuberculosis. Lo and behold, we found 27. And to the Board of Animal Health's credit, not the DNR, because I was in the room, I was on the phone calls when we literally had to choke the leadership and the DNR, and finally through then Governor Pawlenty, to get the DNR to understand that tuberculosis was endemic in a small population of white-tailed deer. And we knew that. Michigan has been fighting with that forever. So the Board of Animal Health, frankly, was directly responsible for forcing the DNR to get serious. And we do not have tuberculosis endemic to white-tailed deer in northwest Minnesota nor any place else that I'm aware of. So it's very easy to pile on when an agency's out there fighting a good fight, trying to straighten something out. Diseases just come and go that way. And I want to remind everybody, just, you know, we hear this kind of chippy stuff about the Board of Animal Health. And for those of you that are not directly involved in agriculture, the fundamental mission of the Board of Animal Health is to protect the food source and the health of every resident in the state of Minnesota. So for those of you that are want to play the line item game about, well, did so much money go for this and the swine folks might not got it, you know, no, that's not what it's about. It's really simple. The Board of Animal Health exists to protect our food source, and it exists to protect our people from diseases like brucellosis, which is a zoonotic that can cause our women to miscarriage. There's a whole bunch of fundamental reasons why this agency exists. And I want to just echo Representative Miller's comment that they do one heck of a good job. And you know, when you're fighting with the disease as tough as chronic wasting disease, it's real easy to pile on. But I think we ought to be helping rather than piling on. That's all I've got to say about it.
Thank you, Representative Lewick. I think Nathan Nelson was next. Representative Nelson.
All right, thank you. And I got a couple of, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple of questions or comments. You know, just wondering on the, you know, the 20% staff time that ends up going, you know, toward the Cervidae farms. And at the same time, looking at, you know, when you talk about like African swine fever, you know, and that's just how much, you know, are you able to take from like an African swine fever? Yeah, we may not have to end up spending near as much time on that as a board, but how much, you know, work is collaborating with other states and kind of a national response to that versus, you know, we start looking at, you know, there's seven states that have the Cervid farms under the jurisdiction of basically the Board of Animal Health, and eight of them are kind of under their the natural resources. Now, 35 of them are joint, and you know, there's a whole lot of variance and a really kind of a lack of conformity and unity on the management of Cervidae farms. So how much does that ends up, because you know, there's kind of 50 states all in their own fight against it essentially, and everyone is managing it differently. So how much of that really becomes because there's not maybe the unified response that the swine fever or other things have, you know, is that, does that make a big difference? And what would it look like if, maybe part two of the question, what would it look like, you know, if we did have a joint venture in managing the Cervid farms?
Dr. Thompson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll try to address both of those questions probably intermingled here with my response. First of all, our agency and Dr. Linda Glazer and others head up the Farm Cervid Program. Our agency does participate both regionally and on a national level when it comes to both Farm Cervid generally, but also chronic wasting disease. And there is a USDA meeting coming up next week for, you know, just an example, a meeting coming up next week that Dr. Glazer is going to be part of, which, you know, brings together those, the Cervid staff from USDA, the researchers, and then other states that come together. Now, having said that, that also happens on the natural resources side. Of course, we're not involved on the natural resources side, but certainly Dr. Karstensen and others from Department of Natural Resources share what they find and what they hear from some of those meetings also. So, yeah, you know, there is a difference. Now, if we contrast that with swine production, where we have, you know, some sow farms in North Carolina, the pigs end up getting sent to nurseries in Iowa and then into finishers in Minnesota. I mean, that really holds all of the states together just because of the way swine production works. Poultry production's right behind that. Cervid production, not as much. There's usually maybe one movement across state lines, but it doesn't pull in the states as much as some of those other agricultural pursuits. So Representative Nelson, did I answer your questions kind of on a high level? I mean, this would be a really good discussion to get into.
Yeah,
Representative Nelson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Dr. Thompson, thank you for that. And I think that does help, you know, greatly. I think, you know, just looking at, you know, the difference between, you know, the swine and turkeys and others. I mean, there is a big difference in there. And some, you know, I'm wondering, you know, how effective or, you know, should this be looked at as, you know, managing swine farms, or not, sorry, Cervidae farms rather, as a, you know, should we be looking at this as a joint effort? Because I think there typically has been a little bit of an oil and water response between the DNR and the Board of Animal Health. And I think overall, everybody has the intentions of having a healthy population all the way around and controlling a disease. And you know, do we need to be looking at possibly adjusting how we manage that and, you know, going forward? So, you know, thank you for thank you for your time here today and you know, helping out.
Representative Burkle, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Dr. Thompson, for being here. I can reiterate what Representative Lewick and Representative Miller said. And, you know, from a personal standpoint, after our high path outbreak on my farm, I can tell everyone for certain that the Board of Animal Health was crucial in helping us get through that disaster in 2015. So I've always appreciated the relationship our industry and the turkey industry has had with the Board of Animal Health. And I know I can speak for the other animal livestock industries as well, that the Board of Animal Health does a great job. And as Representative Lewick said, you know, with their mission to protect the health of domestic animals for the food supply, I've always felt that our relationship has been really strong. I got a couple questions, or maybe just a comment. Could you comment on the low path AI situation? As we were taking roll call, I got a notice from the Board of Animal Health on my email that we had another break in Candiota County. So I'm just curious what you're seeing there with low path AI now, the H6 situation. I'm watching that in particular with concern up here. And then beyond that, I got one more question. I'll let you answer that. And then I got one more question, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Peterson, please.
Chair Sundin, Representative Burkle. Yes, 2015 seems like a long time ago, but yet it wasn't. So the low path avian influenza outbreak, looking at my notes right now, and this started back in 2020. And right now, the numbers and the letters assigned is H6N1. So we get concerned when we see H5s and H7s. Those are the ones that can flip over to high path avian influenza. So this is an H6. There are three counties, and it looks to be mainly commercial turkey, Representative Burkle, mainly in that Candiota, Meeker, Stearns County area. The first flocks were identified in October. And again, as I mentioned, there is an industry-driven response since this is a low path and it's an H6. It's wild bird origin is what the National Veterinary Services Lab is telling us about it. The board is assisting with testing and tracking some of the flocks, sending out disease alerts like you just got. We do map for the folks that are involved in turkey production so they can see it on a map. And then we're going to be using some of our case managers to do epi investigations coming up. I think next week is when we're starting. Mr. Chair and Representative Burkle.
Thank you much, Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Zach. Mr. Chair, thank you, Dr. Thompson. I got one more question concerning the CWD. I know I've served on the EDMC for a while on the poultry side. I'm curious if, you know, concerning the CWD situation and the amount of budget you are, I would make the case that the CWD budget wouldn't you make it the correlation that at some level that also applies to cattle too? I mean, your budget's not just for deer farming. You're protecting the cattle industry as well with what you're doing there. So has there been any conversation about maybe an EDMC, you know, specifically focused on CWD? And that's really the gist of my question.
Dr. Thompson.
Chair Sundin, Representative Burkle, that is a very good question. We did have an advisory committee that was, and I believe we technically need to call that a working group within a state agency that was stood up. And that was active up until we started working on our rules document. And then the advisory committee for the rules document came into play. But that working group that we had stood up included, you know, Department of Natural Resources. We tried to involve all aspects of cervid production, and others were involved in that group also. So not called an EDMC, but we did have a working group.
Thank you. Anything further, Representative Burkle?
Nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you. Terrific discussion. I thank you for that presentation. Certainly reminds us of the valuable work that the board does. So. That said, the first bill up today is one of mine. It's House File 138. Vice Chair Vang will take the chair, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Chair Sundin, please move your bill and feel free to begin.
Okay. I would move that House File 138 be laid over for future consideration. When Fond du Lac Band brought forward an interest of seeing Native American on the Board of Animal Health, I wondered what took them so long. This is probably overdue. We should have, could have addressed this a few years back when the interest of introducing elk throughout reservation land, ceded land in Minnesota first came up. And I think it's just an absolute terrific idea to have an entity represented at, on the board that controls so much of the wildlife in so many acres here in Minnesota. So 138 would seat a federally recognized tribal member on the Board of Animal Health. And with me today is a leader from Carlton County, Tribal Chairman Kevin Dupuy, Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, has some comments regarding the bill. Chairman Dupuy, please.
Tribal Chairman Kevin Dupuy, please state your name for the record and proceed with the your testimony.
Well, good day, everybody. My name is Kevin Dupuy, chairman of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. I introduce myself in our language because we're taught when we're young, when we speak to people, that we introduce ourselves in our own language. So I appreciate the time. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear today to provide testimony in favor of HF 138. This bill, as amended by the author, would add additional members of the Board of Animal Health who would be from a federally recognized Indian tribe in the state of Minnesota. The bill is important to ensure that our government, state, and tribal alike are working together on this critical issue of animal health. Our ancestors reserved the right to hunt, fish, and gather on the reservations and on our ceded territory to protect our traditional values and ways of life. As chairman of the Fond du Lac Band, I understand the obligation of my tribal government as to carefully manage our natural resources and to provide the sustainable agriculture. What we do and the actions we take in pursuit of these efforts do not happen in a vacuum. What we do impacts our neighbors, and what our neighbors do impacts us. In particular, the continued spread of the chronic waste and disease in the state has required increased levels of government-to-government consultation on captive and wild animals and management issues. The tribes have found focused, concerted efforts on the problem because the spread of CWD poses an existential threat to our tribal sovereignty in the exercise of our treaty rights. We have dedicated expert staff to research and address the issues and have worked directly with the state on implementing of mitigating measures. As you're all aware, it is not just the tribes that are threatened by CWD. We all have faced with the problems of CWD, and we're all working together to understand and address it. The Board of Animal Health plays a crucial role in this effort, and it is the only agency tasked with protecting the health of captive cervid populations and preventing the spread of disease amongst them. This bill gives our experts to sit at the table and permits our tribal resources to work part and parcel along with those of the Board of Animal Health and understand and combat CWD and whatever else is lingering in the future. It is very critical that we have a combined approach to fighting and solving this problem for the benefits of all. I also heard that the Minnesota Deer Hunter Association has weighed in on this. I am also a deer hunter. I've hunted deer my entire life. It's one of my birthrights based on the treaties and the treaty that we just in 1854 and 1837. I want to quote what was said earlier about the mission to exist, that it exists to protect the food source and protection of the disease. Well, I eat deer not as a sportsman. I eat deer as a right under the treaties 1854 and 1837. I probably eat deer meat more than anybody else that's on this call, and I think it's very important to understand that we use the deer as a food source, and also all the wildlife within our ceded territories in our reservations. I'd like to thank the chairman, Mr. Sermon Sundin, for bringing this bill, and we're looking forward to working with the state and protecting the livestock and resources. I want to make a statement Chairman Sundin made earlier, is that it's about time. Well, I'm new to some of this stuff. When I found out there was a thing that existed as Animal Board of Health, I jumped on the first meeting I could. And I will have to say this. I just like everybody else, sit on a lot of boards within the state of Minnesota and sit on boards with existing with the tribes, not just in the state of Minnesota, but within our region and nationally. And the Board of Animal Health, I would have to say, is a very, 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 very professional board. The job that they're doing is overwhelming in some instances, to understand that how we look together and how we work together and see that there's a resources that affects all of us. And I want to give credit to where credit is due. Being on the calls and listening to the Board of Animal Health and the discussions there is a very, very professional staff that exists there. And I believe they're very, very knowledgeable. And I think the combination of the tribe, state, and other governments with the actions of the Board of Animal Health, we can find a way to curb the principles of CWD and other diseases that may affect the wild herds that affect us all, and most importantly, as a food source for the Anishinaabe people. Miigwech, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chairman Dupuis. Your presence is welcome, and we're grateful that you're able to be here today to testify in support of this bill. Written testimony submitted by the Minnesota Deer Farmers was posted online and provided to members. No others signed up to testify. I also see there were no amendments submitted. And I'll open the floor for questions and discussion from members. And I see Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author, Chair Sundin. I have a question that's just clarification. Is this, and then I might have a follow-up comment to it, Madam Chair, maybe not, depends on the answer, but to the author, is this an additional person on the board, or is it just one of the five that needs to be a member of one of the, I want to make sure I say it right, the recognized, federally recognized tribes in Minnesota?
Chair Sundin?
Thank you, Chair Vang. Actually, my motion today was to lay it over for future consideration. And the reason for that is there's maybe a little bit of work to do due to the fact that there are other bills moving in regards to the Board of Animal Health. And we have not seen the last of the 138. I expect to revisit it at some point.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that, Chair Sundin. And I'll reserve almost all my comment for when we do that, because I certainly support having proper representation here. And I think that if we have a member of a tribe who is one of the board, I can certainly support that. We've had in recent years expansion of this board, and it's kind of brought, maybe I'm just jealous of this, but the Board of Animal Health has been somewhat pure of politics, which is pretty tough to do these days. And I'm not saying this is, okay? That's why I wanted to clarify the question. But there's been efforts to expand the board. And when you look, if this is going to be an additional thing, you look at how the board makeup is. It's based off of professions and skill sets. And I would argue that I'd like to see a vet or a producer that is from one of the tribes that would be involved, and that it would fit within the confines of that, because that's what I think the Board of Animal Health is where it does its best work. And so I certainly will pay attention to this. The way I think this is written, I can fully support it, but that's why I asked for that clarification. So I look forward to the conversation more in the future. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Dupuis, I hope I got your name correctly pronounced. Thanks for being here today. I appreciated your testimony. You said you've, in the past, have been working with the state, and you're all working together, and I applaud that. With an additional member on the Board of Animal Health board, what do you see that would happen differently that that currently isn't happening now, as long as you say that you're already working with the state and all working together pretty well.
Chairman Dupuy?
Thank you for the question. I think the statement that I made was, as my position now, I never knew that the Minnesota Board of Animal Health even existed until somebody told me that this existed and I joined the meeting at that time. So I've been probably involved with it maybe 5 or 6 months max on listening to what's been going on. I think the point of having a tribal representative to there is to look at it at a different lens, or possibly looking at a tribal perspective with it, and to understand that we're obligated to the treaties, and the treaty has been upheld in federal court. So there's an obligation from the federal government to serve under that principle to ensure that that right is carried out with the tribal indigenous people of the state of Minnesota, especially with the Fond du Lac Band, where we're treaty signers to the 1854 treaty, which covers the northeastern part of the state of Minnesota, the 1837 that goes south to northern Washington County, and also into the northern part of Wisconsin, and the 1842 treaty that goes all the way into the UP of Upper Peninsula, Michigan. So within the treaty right principle, it's basically just having a tribal input in it, not to look at something to oppose things, but to have a collective principle like the gentleman just spoke, that what does it mean to have a tribal representative on there? Well, one, you get to see a different look at the principle, and to identify that it's not just a process to under a state regulation, but there's a group of people that have an ability based on federal law to enjoy these resources. And the ceded territories is also a shared resource. So within the shared resource, we believe that we're not part of that process when we should be that process. And I think the knowledge and the historical knowledge of the indigenous people can give some light to also on how this process should work with the indigenous people. But we're looking at it not to just for indigenous people, but we want to be at the table to help across the board. And I think we have the knowledge and the historical teachings and knowledge within our people to explore that. But most importantly, to be at the table, if I'm answering your question, I hope I am, to understand the principles of the indigenous people in the state of Minnesota and why these things are so important to us. There's so many anomalies that exist with CWD on how it's spread, how it isn't spread, and we don't have them answered, just like nobody has been able to answer my question from the beginning, is what does CWD actually do? I know what it does to deer. Can it be transferred to humans? Can it be transferred to canines? Can it be transferred to birds of prey? Can it be transferred to the smaller animals like voles and everything that eat on carrion? These are questions that concern us that would affect our entire ecosystems within our ceded territory and our reservation boundaries. I hope I answered your question.
Follow-up, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Dupuy, yes, you did very fully. I have one additional question for the author of the bill, if he would stand for one very quick question.
Certainly.
Please proceed.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Sundin, the governor appoints these members to the Board of Animal Health. Could he not currently do that if he so choose, being these are appointments made by the governor?
Chair Sundin?
I imagine he could, but I don't think it's the intent of the governor to displace anybody that's currently on the board, given their sphere of the sphere of knowledge of agriculture and animal husbandry, all of the above. So I don't think the governor is ready to displace anybody on that board.
Okay. Members, just want to give a quick reminder that we have about 10 minutes left blocked for this bill. And so please keep your comments or remarks, questions concise. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Dupuy, thank you for being here and providing your government's perspective on the bill. I think it is very needed to the bill. I think it is important to expand the board that I often give the presentation that the world has changed. We are not the same state that we were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, or 75 years ago. And having the board be three farmers and two veterinarians most of the presentation we've heard so far today has been talking about agriculture. But today, most of the veterinarians are with small animals and companion animals. And how do those potential diseases that they may have jump into human contact? That hasn't been a focus. And so I think what adding a tribal member, a tribal representative, excuse me, on the board, adding to the board provides different perspective. And I think there needs to be more additions to the board, because often what happens here is it's always, let's never change anything, ever. Let's never change anything, ever, because this is the way we've always done it. And this isn't the way it always has been. With tribal representation, it's not that the world has changed. We need to listen to the folks who were here before us. They give a different perspective. That's a different perspective that's needed not only on this board, but other places as well. And we shouldn't be afraid of dissenting or different or just plain never heard from before opinions. And it's always, don't ever change anything, because something might happen. Something might happen. Well, things do happen. We're in the middle of a pandemic right now. And so in that crisis, there is the opportunity to do things better, to adjust to a new reality. And adding a tribal member is one small, a tribal representative is one small step. And I think there also needs to be others. Good job, Chair Sundin.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Sundin, for bringing this bill forward. I would remind Representative Hansen that we are in the middle of a pandemic. And as we've walked our way through this pandemic for the last year, we've been told to follow the science. And I guess most of my questions have been answered. Representative Miller asked the question I was going to ask. So the only comment I'd make is the goal and the mission of the Board of Animal Health is scientific. And I'm hoping that as we move forward, and I'm glad you're laying this over, but we protect the mission of the Board of Animal Health here. We have industries that rely on its expertise. And I'm afraid that if change for the sake of change is what we're going for, we'll lose the idea of following the science. So as we walked our way through the HIPAA epidemic back in 15, I can tell you that all the tabletop exercises that we walked through with the Board of Animal Health really helped us as an industry get through the problem we faced in that disaster in 15. So I appreciate the bill coming forward. I appreciate the idea of tribal input. I hope we follow the science here and keep the mission of the Board of Animal Health intact. Thank you.
Representative Lulick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to compliment Chair Dupuy for one, showing up, and I share your concern about those questions that we don't have answered, some of them not at all, and some of them only partially, as to the mechanics of how this chronic wasting disease works. And I just want to tell you, as a neighbor to your immediate west, I want to extend my hand to work with you on any way that we can move this thing forward. I work with Chief Executive Benjamin on a variety of things, little bit off topic, I want to extend my personal thanks on behalf of Sheriff Guida and our public safety people in Aiken County for the hard work that your folks are doing to make sure we just keep everybody safe and allow everybody to have their say their piece and that type of thing. But again, I just want to publicly extend my hand to you directly that I'm ready to do whatever we can, because chronic wasting disease, you probably have better deer hunting luck than I do, but I eat my fair share of venison myself. I kind of grew up on it too. So thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Sundin, do you have any closing comments before you renew your motion?
I'll be brief. I'd like to thank the band for bringing forward this proposal. It just proves that we have shared interests in the state of Minnesota. And I think it's very important that we move down this path together. Remember that the original Minnesotans have a stake in the wildlife and animals in the state of Minnesota. So I renew my motion here that this 138 be laid over for future consideration.
Okay, thank you, Chair Sundin and Chairman Dupuy. And with that, House File 138 is laid over. And I'll return the gavel to Chair Sundin.
We have House File 701, Representative Lippert, Soil and Health Farming Goals Established, Soil Health Farming Financial Incentives Created, Data Collection Required, Data Classified, and Money Appropriated. Representative Lippert, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 701 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law.
Okay, you heard the motion. Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We all depend on healthy soil. Helping farmers protect soil will benefit farmers and small towns and cities across the state now and in generations to come. There are farmers now who are experimenting with soil health building practices like cover crops, perennial crops, no-till and low-till, managed rotational grazing, and more. They're excited about the differences they're seeing in their soil. There's more organic matter, the soil can absorb more water, the practices are improving water quality. Farmers are able to reduce fuel costs and fertilizer costs over time too. These practices, especially those that establish grasses and perennial crops, can be a part of the climate solution too. Some soil scientists have more optimistic carbon sequestration assessments than others, but even the cautious scientists believe that these practices can play a role in helping us meet our climate goals. We also know that these practices will help farmland be as resilient as possible as we face increasingly heavy rain events due to climate change. More farmers would like to experiment with these practices, but financial support and technical assistance is needed to help farmers make this transition. It can take 3 to 5 years until these practices become profitable for farmers. And when money is tight, it's hard to take a short-term risk for a long-term gain. Just yesterday, I was in conversation with a farmer about another topic, and I mentioned this hearing this afternoon on soil health, and the farmer held up a catalog of cover crops and said, I want to try these, but I went to my banker, and my banker said, and I told my banker, this will be profitable in the long run, but my banker wasn't convinced. I'm trying to figure out how to get started. So the bill that was written and built by Minnesota farmers has two main parts. First, it sets goals. 50% of Minnesota farmers implementing cover crops, perennial crops, no-till, or managed rotational grazing by 2030. 100% of Minnesota farmers implementing the same practices by 2035. And these practices on 100% of Minnesota farmland in one way or another by 2040. States can make fast progress on implementing these practices. In response to a requirement to improve the water quality of Chesapeake Bay in 2010, Maryland put forward an aggressive cover crops or cost share program for cover crops. 10 years later, they have cover crops in over 50% of their farmland. The focus of this bill is to put a similar robust cost share program in place in Minnesota. So the second part of the bill is the cost share program itself. The program will be administered through the Board of Soil and Water Resources, and we've been in conversation with Bowser about this. Bowser will provide grants through soil and water conservation districts, and it's important to note that adequate funding of SWCDs has to be addressed along with any work related to cover crops. Farmers will be eligible for upfront cost grants not to exceed $15,000. Farmers can also receive direct payments. Now, I have an author's amendment that didn't get posted in time to clarify this section, but farmers, regardless of farm size, will be able to receive up to $12,500 per year for cropping practices, up to $17,500 per year for managed rotational grazing practices for up to 5 years. The strategy behind the payment structure is to reach as many farmers as possible first, knowing that acres will follow. We want as many farmers trying these practices, talking with their neighbors about what they're seeing and learning. And as these practices move from being new to normal, that we'll start seeing the change we need to see. Equity is a concern in the bill, and there's a priority list for awarding grants related to equity. Data collection and measurements, another section in the bill. There's a lot of research to be done on how these practices build organic matter and sequester carbon in different soil types. Our plans to ask for $2.75 million to be appropriated from the general fund to Bowser in each of the next 2 years. We also know the federal government's interest in supporting these practices nationwide, and we want to be able to signal to the federal government that we have a strong plan in place in Minnesota that can help scale these practices up. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll ask my first testifier to chime in, Shona Snader from the LSP, or from Land Stewardship Project.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Shona Snader. I work in the soil health program at the Land Stewardship Project. Today, I'm calling you from my home in Preston, Minnesota, where I live one block north of the Root River in the Driftless region. If you know our corner of the state, then you know that with our karst topography, the effects of extreme weather are very evident on our bluffs and in our freshwater streams. It is a real concern for our trout populations, soil erosion, and our drinking water. Through my organizing experience with farmers, I've come to recognize, along with many farmers, that practices like no-till with cover crops and rotational grazing sequesters carbon, builds soil tilth, and in turn improves water quality and resiliency to weather. Building soil health also saves farmers time, money, and contributes to resilient rural economies. I'm in support of this bill because direct investments in making soil health practices profitable has shown in other states to increase adoption. Maryland has 50% of their farmland in cover crops after incentivizing farmers, like Representative Lippert said. And just for reference, in Minnesota, we are around 2-3%. This bill financially helps farmers by diversifying what is grown on the land and producing additional forage for livestock. I support investing in farmers because they want to do what is right for the land and water. I also know that farmers who have access to funds without many barriers like excessive paperwork and have technical and farmer-to-farmer educational support have great experiences implementing these practices. It will be important to have the boots-on-the-ground support of our local soil and water conservation districts and the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Learning to implement these practices well is not easy for farmers. There is a learning curve of about 3 to 5 years. So let's be sure to help them through this learning process. Farmers are the solution to climate change. Let's help them do that job. I hope to have your support in passing forward this bill and ensuring our communities and farmers are invested in and resilient for the future. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my next testifier is Luke Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Luke Peterson. I run 700 acre organic farm in Boston, Minnesota. We have a very diverse rotation that includes corn, soybeans, wheat, winter wheat, alfalfa, flax, barley, oats, perennial pasture, and kernza. We have started a grass-fed beef herd, and we have eliminated all fall tillage, and we plant pollinator strips on the border of our farms. We direct market a lot of our crops, and we try to sell them as local as possible. We are focusing more and more on putting as many perennials into the rotation as possible. Like I said earlier, we plant alfalfa, kernza, and are adding rotational pasture to our system. These crops are important for the future of our farms. They build resiliency into the system by building deep root systems that store carbon in the soil. They reduce and or eliminate tillage and the need for large amounts of chemical and fertilizer applications. They also give me a feed source to bring livestock back onto the farm and multiple income streams. Cover crops in a system gives me another feed source for my livestock and helps me supply fertility to my fertility to my soil. On an organic farm, it also helps suppress weeds. Paying the right farms to implement these practices helps them through the transition phase of being able to afford the costs that go along with implementation. Reducing the barriers for farmers to implement these practices and see the changes it can have on their farm, like I have, is necessary to help transition us to more soil-healthy farming practices and build our collective resilience. Farming that provides a public good should have public support.
Thank you very much, Mr. Peterson. The next Mr. Peterson from Rice County, please be brief with your comments. We will be voting on this bill today.
Okay, it looks like we got you guys outnumbered here as Petersons. So Mike Peterson here. Thank you, Chair Sundin, Representative Lippert and committee for the opportunity to testify here today regarding HF 701, and tell the story of our farm 1 mile east of Northfield. Here, along with my wife, Kay, and two sons, Blake and Shane, we farm approximately 800 acres of cropland and raise hogs as a contract grower. The land we farm is primarily lighter, without irrigation or tile drainage, which means we have a pretty thin layer of topsoil. Our practices on that soil are, for the most part, no-till for our soybeans and zone tillage for our row crop corn, with cover crops being slowly integrated into our methods. Soil health and water retention are key to our soil types in a location we farm, which for the most part are watersheds leading to the Cannon River with basically no wetlands in between. So if we get it wrong, we're kind of a main line right to the Cannon River. So therefore, we respect the views of the Cannon River Watershed Partnership, which we're members of. And as we invest in more towards cover crops and play the long game towards better soil health, keep in mind that we as farmers use our land, our production system's success, and our family's financial well-being as our research funding, which is why we need organizations like the Land Stewardship Project, the CRWP, SWCDs, NRCS offices, and policymakers to all help in getting us where we need to be without being pushed over a financial cliff. I know people participating in this meeting today have heard the benefits of better soil, cleaner water and air, as well as the fact that we improve our soil health, we can sequester more carbon, which for me, the land I farm may be able to help out other crop production systems that are more carbon intensive. And what I mean by that is basically, all of agriculture in general probably can benefit if a lot of us do well as far as sequestering carbon. Things that come to mind are sugar beets and potatoes that have a hard time with their crop mat and whatnot and probably couldn't plant cover crops until after harvest. I can integrate or interseed and go along with that, so maybe we can help out. I do believe in the future farmers have to and will do better. I do see improvements in practices already being made. Climate's not the only challenge we face in agriculture, but with cooperation on all sides between producers, the public, and the public, we can continue to have a healthy and abundant food supply as well as be part of the solution. And I really appreciate this opportunity, and I welcome any questions.
To the committee, we have time for one question. If there is one question, make it a good one. Hearing none, seeing none.
Mr. Chair, this is Nancy. You did have one other person sign up to testify before you vote.
Oh, I missed that one. Is that, who would that be?
Miss Vanny. Okay. Sheila Vanny.
Miss Vanny, would you pause? Okay, I see it now. Okay. Ms. Vanny, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sheila Vanny, and I'm the Assistant Director for the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. We represent Minnesota's 88 SWCDs, the 440 men and women who serve on their elected governing boards, and their employees. I want to take this opportunity to thank Representative Lippert for carrying House File 701 and for those who were involved in helping draft the language. It's exciting to see the recognition that this bill gives to SWCDs as having the landowner relationships and technical expertise at the local level to continue to implement soil health practices, both on tilled acres as well as grazed acres. Approximately 70 of our 88 SWCDs are co-located at the local field office level with our partners at USDA. SWCDs work closely with the Natural Resources Conservation Service, or NRCS, and the Farm Services Agency, or FSA, on programs and practices that complement our soil health efforts. And SWCDs are trained and credentialed to implement soil health practices that follow technical standards established by USDA NRCS. We are still working on reviewing all of the details of the bill and getting input from our SWCDs, but one observation we would offer is that the administrative components set out for SWCDs are pretty significant. And I think Mr. Chair and Representative Lippert, there was some recognition in your opening comments that funding for SWCDs would be a pretty critical piece of this as it goes forward. So we thank you for that. But just want to highlight the ranking, payment calculations, costs, documentations, and payment processing do present substantial workload for SWCDs. And so we would want to make sure that the districts get funding for implementing these aspects, as well as, you know, actually providing the technical expertise and project cost share that we are more accustomed to providing. Mr. Chair, those are our brief comments. I just, again, want to thank Representative Lippert for bringing the bill forward. We look forward to continuing the conversations on strengthening and enhancing the existing SWCD role with agricultural producers on soil health practices. So, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vaney. We have time for two quick questions. Representative Hansen, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would support moving the bill on today because it eventually will come to my budget area and to my committee, and I think the conversation needs to continue. And one component of that is if the federal government does invest in soil health, I think we need to have some mechanism for receiving that money. There needs to be some type of catch that we have that we can capture those funds that could implement them. So I think it's important to keep this conversation going. Should recognize the bill may look a bit different when it comes out of if it comes out of our committee. Thank you.
Representative Anderson, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I have a couple of questions, and this is the Finance Committee as well. So my questions pertain to the financing part. And to the bill author, Representative Lippert, is this going to be one-time funding? I've noticed you've got the payment set up here for a five-year period. How do you intend to fund this for that length of time?
Representative Lippert, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the question, Representative Anderson. We're wanting to set up a robust cost share program that will need to continue going forward. And we know these needs aren't going to change. And we also know that farmers need support through 3 to 5 years. So, what we're dealing with related to this bill is funding for a couple years for this next budget cycle. But we will be wanting to invest in this program going forward.
Follow up, Representative Anderson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Your goals are laudable. I agree with the goals in the bill. A lot of them farmers are doing already. And notice rotational grazing, that pays for itself. When you get those paddocks set up, it pays for itself and increased production. A lot of these things, as I mentioned, farmers already doing. Maryland was also mentioned is a great place for cover crops. I agree with that. But again, Maryland's climate is somewhat different than we are here. They're along the ocean, we're north. Establishing cover crops can be a challenge here in this part of the country. And, we have 26 million acres of cropland in Minnesota. And that's a big chunk to bite off. And I would again remind people that we have the water quality certification program. We heard the other day there are over 1,000 farmers enrolled already and over 700,000 acres in that program. I fully support that program as well. It's a well-rounded approach to address issues in farming. So we are working on this situation and agree that more work can be done on this bill, and I look forward to seeing that as the bill moves on. And thank you, Representative Lipper.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Okay, Representative Lipper, you have the final word, and you can renew your motion, and we'll take a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the time of the committee. I think there's a lot of conversation and energy around these practices. And so the time is right for us really to be digging into this topic and moving a program like this forward. So I ask for your support and renew my motion that House File 701 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law.
Committee, we've heard the motion. Mr. Smith, take the roll on motion.
Chair Sundin?
Aye.
Sundin votes aye. Vang?
Aye.
Vang votes aye. Anderson?
Anderson, aye.
Anderson votes aye. Burkle?
Aye.
Burkle, aye. Eklund?
Aye.
Eklund votes aye. Hansen R?
Hansen R, aye.
Hansen R, aye. Hansen J?
Hansen J, aye.
Hansen J, aye. Cleavorn?
Aye.
Cleavorn, aye. Lippert?
Lippert, aye.
Lippert, aye. Lewick?
Lewick, aye.
Lewick, aye. Miller?
No.
Miller, no. Nelson?
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Thompson? Thompson? That's 11 ayes and one nay, Mr. Chair.
Okay, on a vote of 11 to 1, the motion prevails, and Bill will move on to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Thank you, Representative Lippert, and testifiers. Thanks to everyone for your participation today. It was a good hearing on both concerns. On Monday, we're going to hear presentations from Next Generation and Emerging Farmers and take up a number of bills. This meeting is adjourned.